what we're supposed to do.
Pete Chrisley, this is an honor to have one of the greatest living musicians on this podcast, Journey of an Aesthetic Podcast. And there's so much I could say by way of introduction to say that, except I'll say two things up front. I think the first time I heard you was on Louis Belson's album, the Explosion album, and your great solo with Harry Nilsson, Open Your Window.
Harry.
Loud playing, but that was my first time hearing you.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I heard you with Tom Waits, you know, I was a young, at that time, I was a child. I was a boy. I was 74. I would have been, you know, 6 or 7 years old. I'd watch you on The Tonight Show, Johnny Carson, and hear you. And then I actually had the opportunity, you won't remember this, I actually met you in Paris. Remember in 1992, you were at La Villa? Remember La Villa?
Well, do you remember very lucky to get that gig. It was like they said, well, we'd love to have you and everything, but, you know, and I said, well, I'll tell you what, you throw in a room and we'll just come and play. Well, and it worked. So I got a room.
Right.
It was so small, you had to go out in the hall to change your mind, you know. But
well, the thing about I remember that is that it was a local rhythm section, a French rhythm section.
Yeah, they were very good.
I was traveling with my dad. My dad was there and my dad's wife. And I remember that you and I had the opportunity to talk about Bill Evans, Turn Out the Stars.
We recorded that. With a group in Nashville. It turned out really great. I love Bill Evans. I got to meet him in person when he came to the Tonight Show with Tony Bennett.
Right, right.
And it was so unique because he was wearing a suit and he was clean as a whistle and playing great and it changed his whole life, you know, at that time. So we started talking about Warren Marsh.
Right.
Because he lived in New York and Warren lived in New York. And so.
You recorded a wonderful album with Warren Marsh, Apogee, with the Donald Pagan song. Remember?
Yeah, I had one on my label too. It was one of my first albums that I decided after Apogee and going through all this rigmarole with Steely Dan, you know, it was like, well, we love what you're doing, but we want to tie strings to you and make you dance like a puppet and let's do this and let's do that.
Yeah.
And that really offended everybody. And Warren, he put his horn in his case and went back to New York.
Right, sure.
He was gone, you know.
But before we get too far into the future of the present, I wanted to begin at the beginning with your family was musical and your father was working with the movies, right? I have two questions that that's a sort of a classical kind of start. Your father was, you know, playing
He was a bassoon player extraordinaire, and he wrote a book that's in many libraries on the art of making your own reeds, which is what the major thing a bassoon player needs is to be able to make a reed, because you've got a $40,000-$50,000 instrument that's useless without this reed on it, you know, and it has to be made right, or it's not even going to be. It's not going to be a decent duck call, you know.
Right.
It won't work, you know. So you have to learn to work with your hands. You have to be coordinated. You have to be able to pick out a piece of wood, because it takes a week to make a reed. And if you've got a piece of wood that's no good, you're wasting your time.
Right. Well, the reed's pretty important, sure. But I'm just wondering that the transformation when you got the jazz bug or got, you know, discovered jazz music, or that must have happened when you were.
Violin was my first instrument.
What was?
Violin.
Violin was your first instrument.
Yeah. Well, you know, because He was a major player in the the modern music presentations on Monday night concerts in Los Angeles, where he had Stravinsky who came to town. Stravinsky was in our house when I was about six or seven years old, and they were rehearsing all this music with Stravinsky to do concerts. A lot of them were at UCLA in the big concert hall, Royce Hall. And Stravinsky was in heaven in the house when he was rehearsing. He according to my father, he deeply enjoyed being at one with the musicians rehearsing. And as far as he was concerned, my father said the concert was anticlimactic.
Right.
Those were his words, which I find, very interesting.
You were close.
We like to play, for people.
Well, you were close to that era of the 40s and 50s, that Hollywood Bowl and the Hollywood and all the. So what would have been some of the scores your father played on, the film scores that you can
remember? 750 motion pictures he did at 20th Century Fox.
Wow.
When he started, what he did at MGM, his first picture was whichever came first, Gone with the Wind or Wizard of Oz.
Wizard of Oz.
He was all over that film. He had solos, on practically everything that went on in that motion picture, but there were little solos.
That's a different. I'm just thinking, in terms of composition and scoring, that's an entirely different era than what would come in the 60s and 70s with the Michael Smalls, and the Patrick Williams and David, different styles and different. There's so many changes of David Shire, so many.
All these people you're mentioning, I had worked with at least once. David Shire, I did The Taking of Pelham.
That's right.
That was
that's a great piece of music. That's one of my favorite scores of his, and you're great on it, of course.
It was my first experience with him, and he was great to work for,
So another name that comes to mind is Patrick Williams. Did you do any of his charts?
Yeah, we did. We went back and forth for years, He was very, I've never met anybody quite just like that. He seemed to be very easygoing and everything, which he was. But he and I, over the years, we went back and forth. Near the end, he was, all of a sudden, we were playing concerts together again, and everything was just fine, So
were you on any? Did you do any of the TV scores he did? Like say,
Lou Grant,
or are you on Lou Grant or Mary Tyler Moore or any of those or that?
No, I don't think I did. I did his very first album,
Threshold.
Threshold, one of the first albums that he did in Los Angeles. It was before Threshold. It was coming out party for him.
And
I sat next to Billy Byers, who was one of the finest writers ever.
Well, the writing on those early albums, he changes as a composer because those early albums are a little more like Think, for example, or the mood things that Patrick Williams was doing. With Threshold, he gets much more jazz oriented and much like the stuff he was doing at Dante's.
Were you
part of that orchestra at Dante's? Or was that a different? Was that probably?
No, I wasn't. Like I said, one of my all time best friends and the most talented guy in the world is Tom Scott. And Tom worked with him exclusively for a long time. And I came along when Tom got busy.
Right.
Tom was, of course, being Tom, he was really busy all the time because everybody loved the way he played. And then I ended up playing in orchestras when Tom did the score and was conducting. He was man, he listened. His pop was a composer, right. And
well, I remember this brings to mind. You know, of course, you're very famous for the Steely Dan, working on Aja and Steely Dan and yeah. Black Cow and Deacon Blues. But you said something interesting. You said that you saw Donald Fagen and Walter Becker as more producers. Is that true? Is that kind of the way?
Well, that's what happened. I'll tell you. Yeah. After I did Deacon Blues,
yeah,
that was our first meeting, and it was very interesting because I thought, you know, I came from the Tonight Show. The Tonight Show starts at 5:15. Right. 30, and it's over at 6:30 in Los Angeles,
right.
On Los Angeles time.
And right.
They don't even start the show until 11 o'clock, and that's, you know, that's because the difference, time difference between here and New York.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You know, anyway, to get back to this, they said, can you play a solo? You know, that's what we did. When the show was over at 6:30, we went on and either played a concert played in a club with a big band, or we went and did some kind of studio work at 7 or 8 o'clock. You know,
so at that period,
I went there and I did this solo and I played one, I made a one pass on the damn thing, and they said, "That's it. Don't change a thing. We're done." You know, and everybody else I ever saw said, man, they made me do 50 shots.
Right, but I want to express my love for your playing as many things. I mean, first of all, your tone and sound is phenomenal, and your swing and your melodic lines and the soulfulness and the blues and all that is in your playing. But what's interesting is that when you talk about these record dates, now, when I think of the Steely Dan work you did, I think of Black Cow the most. Uh-huh. That might be my favorite. Either because I like the changes on that more than Deacon Blues, or because is it kind of all run together? Does Black Cow stick out in your mind, or is it?
I just, you know, Tom, the guy who made that album,
yeah,
what it is, was Tom's writing,
right?
And you know, they brought in soloists, and brought in guys from New York to
sure.
play solos and things, and it was quite an experience because the next thing we did was a score for a movie called FM.
That's it.
Yeah, it was called
Black Cow. That's where you play Black Cow. Yeah, I played Black Cow.
No, it was a theme for the movie.
On the theme FM, right? Run the theme.
Yeah,
FM.
Yeah, and my friend, a longtime friend, and I worked with him a lot, was Johnny Mandel, who did the arrangements and everything. So I was playing with the strings and Johnny Mandel, and it was, hey man, it made it real easy.
FM was a beautiful chart, a beautiful song, yeah. And great changes. And I yeah. always kind of wish they had you as the outro solo rather than the guitar. I don't know, was it Larry Carlton or Lee Ritenour, one of those?
Well, beggars can't be choosy. You know, right. I got the guys that they brought on from New York. Wayne Shorter played on that album.
He did on Asia, right?
Well, he had an agent, and he probably got a few thousand dollars to come from.
Oh, New no,
York. I got $300.
Wow.
Yeah, and people say, hey, I'll bet that was, I said, well, and they said, can you do a solo that on my album like you did? I said, well, yeah. They said, well, what'd they pay you? And I said, oh, $1,500. So that got me some more money, but it didn't last very long, you know.
Yeah, 300 doesn't go as far as 1,000. Well, probably 1,000 doesn't go very far either.
I won't even buy a tank of gas now.
Right, sure. But the thing that fascinates me is you coming from this classical background, meeting Stravinsky and violin. And I'm wondering, when you first became having facility and blowing over changes and playing jazz.
Well,
hold on. What makes my point is that I'm thinking that it would have been exposure to West Coast people like Bob Cooper. Was it mainly Shelly Mann?
He was my teacher, Bob Cooper, my teacher.
Okay.
And he was learning how to make reeds because Bob was an oboe player. And my father worked with people on teaching him how to make reeds for oboe and bassoon because it's very similar. It's just a little narrower, a little smaller, but same principle and everything. So Bob was there learning how to make reeds from my father in the house. And then I would go down to the lighthouse. When I first got into it,
Lighthouse was one of the greatest jazz clubs in Los at that time. I would say Dante's, the Lighthouse, the Baked Potato. But go ahead. Yeah, Lighthouse. Yeah.
Well, I was a violin player, and the reason that the saxophone thing came around was that they left jazz records in the record player. It's a big an old style cabinet where you lift the lid and there's this thing and you move the arm back and you put the record on and the changer and blow them. And well, this is a little record. It was the 10-inch record and it was green. And it's Jerry Mulligan and Chet Baker.
That was the, yeah.
Yeah, Turnstile, Lines for Lions.
Lines, yeah.
Line all for that stuff. So, and the guys on it were Carson Smith, who I ended up working with and knew very well. And then Larry Bunker was the drummer, and he became a percussionist in Los Angeles who, you know, he was on every movie, everything. He was all over this thing.
Being Larry Bunker and John Guerin are two.
Right. John Guerin, I played with John Guerin, and he was the most wonderful drummer ever. God, the way he did things differently. He started on saxophone. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
He was a tenor player.
Interesting.
Yeah, I got a kick out of that.
What made John Guerin stand out among drummers? Was it the way he played grooves or the way he could swing?
Oh, the groove. He had the most amazing imagination for creating a thing between the hi-hat and the ride cymbal and everything. He wasn't one of those guys that could, you know, use a bass drum all day long. He was all over the set and creating grooves that coincided with the groove that was going on with the bass and the piano and everything. He could almost like a double time feel, a double time feel behind it, which really swung hard and made you want to play. You know, he made you want to play. I'll tell you this, when he played his solos, he really got into it. And if you didn't count, he'd dump you in the weeds, man.
Did people get lost?
He wouldn't be there when you were supposed to be, when you're coming back in. You know, it was like embarrassing, you know, if you weren't counting, you know, you were, you know. He'd do something that's so abstract and stretch the time out.
Right, but
it's almost impossible to keep one, two, three going in your head because it's going up. It's like, wow, like that, you know.
So were your first large big gigs Louis Belson and Johnny Carson, or was that late? Was that the round?
No one got me on that because when I was a youngster, I ended up on Louis' band.
Right.
It was my road days when I left school.
Yeah.
I couldn't wait to get out of school.
Right.
And go play. I tell the students when you do clinics and things like that, that I left home at between 16 and 17 years old. I was on the road with the band, traveling back and forth across the country, and it was like earn while you learn situation. And people say, "Well, where'd you go to school?" I said, I graduated from the Greyhound School because I went from this band to that band and, you know, bus here, bus there, but living on a bus.
Right.
And
who were the bands?
My first band was Cy Zentner, who was a real character. He had worked at MGM when my father was doing Gone with the Wind. He was in there. He was in that orchestra. And then We went on the road. He had a hit called that Bob Florence wrote the chart for Up a Lazy River that got him started with his band traveling. And when I quit that band, I did a
stint. I'm just going to hold this up because this is an example of Bob Florence. That's right. Westlake.
Dee 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 da da dee da da, right? Things like that.
Yeah.
Wonderful guys in that band, and I was subbing for Bob Hardaway in the band. Bob had to have some surgery or something, and so I subbed, and then he kept me on, and I don't even know if he even bothered to call Bob and say don't play with the band anymore because I got this guy. You know, and it's a little embarrassing, you know, and it was like, anyone didn't do this just to take somebody's job. I mean, but there I was, you know, so we made up and worked together a lot, me and Bob, and so it turned out okay.
Yeah.
I was... In order to get my records out and do stuff that I wanted to, it was really difficult to just go get somebody to make you a star and put you on records. It just didn't happen. It wasn't there. It's not like the movies. It don't happen like that, man. You got to really be connected with somebody who's ready. You know, you need an agent. You need a lot of things going for you to get a contract with a record company. Now, Steely Dan got me a contract with Warner Brothers when we decided to do the Apogee album.
Yeah.
And it was 30 pages long in fine print. And what it said in the fine print that I found out was that the contract was for five records at 5 years, options for records and all this fancy stuff. And here's your $10,000, it was $7,000 or $10,000 joining fee, which I split with Warren Marsh.
Right, of course.
And after the record was over, the contract went out the window.
Huh.
Because it says in fine print on page 33 that we have the right to dissolve this at any time. So goodbye. And I didn't write the contract, and I didn't have a lawyer to read through it and make sure that that clause was not there, you know. Lucky me, so.
At that time, you were still with an NBC, with a Tonight Show band, right? Weren't you still in the?
Yeah, it went 20 years. From 1970 or something like that.
20 years you were with Johnny Carson. Do you have any stories about Johnny Carson? Any memories, anything that comes to mind?
First of all, if it wasn't for Johnny Carson, they would have replaced that band with a monkey and an organ grinder and kept the money and put it in their pocket. There was an undercurrent of, let's see, how we can screw the band this week. I mean, it was like they kept coming up with things that were, they were always, because we got rerun money. Yeah. In those days, we had a contract like these are the things that the writers and television people go to, they strike about things like, well, we want these rights to residuals.
Right.
I mean, the whole world is built on residuals for this and that and this. That's why we have ASCAP and BMI, right? The two towers of the industry, you know, and how people get paid. And I'm still getting little checks for things I did years ago because of of that network of,
So what you're saying is that Johnny Carson defended the musicians who believed in the band.
Well, he wouldn't let them replace him because he was a frustrated
drummer.
Drummer, and he had drummers on the show. Okay. I I was working with Louis, and I got, when I produced the album, Don't Stop Now with Louis' band, I took a copy to Johnny, and Johnny was just absolutely, hey, man, he says, I'll tell you what, he says, can you have Louis here on this date, and we'll pull up the album, and you know, I mean, that was like a $30,000 ad.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like a father to the guys in the band. If they had something, he would hold up their stuff.
He would, yeah.
Here, hey, listen, see this? This is my buddy over there. And
and
he would, if we were playing somewhere, would he'd like to come over and sit in on drums?
Wow.
Like at Dante's when Louis band
Dante's
played.
Right.
Yeah. And so, and for 20 years, he was our greatest ally, you know, and everything. And he loved to have the band. What we did for 20 years was keep 300 people occupied while they showed commercials, which was really the network of
right.
The reason for the whole show was they were selling things. And these people who came all the way from, God, who knows, Iowa, you know, Michigan, whatever. They came here and they want to see Johnny Carson's show. And then they get there and it's two minutes of show and 5 minutes of commercials. I'm sure they would say, well, geez, we could have stayed home. But here the band is just roaring, keeping them occupied while they sold their stuff. So that I did my best work behind Alpo Dog
Food. Dog Commissioner.
You know.
Well, it's great.
Really happy to get like that, you know, just
didn't you write, you didn't, didn't you write a chart for them, the band played? Or
I did. I wrote a couple. Guys writing charts made a lot of money because they needed material. And if you were good at writing, you submitted, you automatically got a shot at having your stuff played on television. And if they play your chart on one of those things where they say we're featuring the band, remember once in a while we got a feature. If they play it, you get $1,000. So what happens
when you did that,
during a commercial, a few weeks later, I'd get a check for $100. So if you wrote 1,000 charts for the band, you'd be really making good money if they played your stuff, you know?
That's true.
That's what I try to tell kids. Learn how to write. It's another source of income that will really, you know, hey, you're missing out if you're not.
When you did, I'm just trying to remember, I know that you were featured with Don Menza, right? In Sax Alley. I think that was one of them.
And
so
that
was going to be, so when that was for the public or the audience at home can watch that.
Oh, that was that wasn't Don. It was Ernie Watts. Ernie Watts was on.
Ernie Watts, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Don played with Louis' band.
Yeah, right.
We had, you remember that tune he wrote, Time Check?
Yes.
Yeah. Everybody's played it. It's been played for 100 years and it goes like a rocket.
You and Ernie Watts are a great combination. I mean, Ernie Watts,
we sat next together. Together next to each other for 20 years, and he's a great guy, and he worked very hard. He practiced, you know, and it's paid off. Every once in a while I turn on XM radio and I hear him playing, and he's still going great. You know, it's wonderful. We were good friends, I think one thing had happened. He left the show.
Yeah.
He went out with a Rolling Stone.
That's right.
And he made $60,000.
Huh.
And he got home, and his wife divorced him and took the $60,000. Yeah, man, can you believe that? You know, it's like, you know.
You've heard
before, but that one's true, and man,
it is true. But you play, you know, you are among, so when you think about musicians like yourself that have an identifiable sound, like you, Joe Farrell, Tom Scott, or saxophonists that you know you hear, I can hear two notes and I can tell it's Pete Chrisley. But just hear
it's a mouthpiece combination,
right?
Reed mouthpiece.
Yeah.
I was very lucky that in the Musicians Union in the early years, my early years, uh-huh. Musicians Union was on Vine Street in Los Angeles was there.
Right.
Before I was born, my father, you know, took me to the union when I got my first card, my union card as a youngster. There was a music shop next to the rehearsal rooms in the parking lot, and that was Maury Stein,
uh-huh.
whose brother was Julie Stein,
the composer. Right.
And Maury played the saxophone, and he had a mouthpiece on a shelf, and I was playing this mouthpiece that kind of a mouthpiece that that comes with a horn in the case. You know, it's really it works better as a doorstop than a mouthpiece.
You right. know?
But so I'd heard about these mouthpieces, and my first teacher got me a Berg Larsen mouthpiece, which was. Berg Larsen made wonderful mouthpieces.
Right.
They were all hand finished by him. And the ones that he finished over the years that he was alive were all great players. Later on, when he passed away, he basically took the romance, a secret of how to make a mouthpiece great. He took that with him when he died. Mm-hmm. And the things they were making after that were not the same mouthpiece.
Huh.
So, everybody, it's like a vintage Selmer saxophone. You know, the older ones go for thousands more than the new ones, and the new ones were not quite as good as the old ones. And it took them a long time to get back to making good saxophones because they made Selmer made a horn that it was so, actually there was two scales on it. The first scale is the low end of the horn and you put the octave key on and then it became a quarter tone sharp on the upper side because they changed the dimensions of the horn.
Huh.
And you don't screw with nature. You know, it only took them 100 years to come up with the Mark VI, which was the standard of all saxophones forever. And then, all of a sudden, they stretch it out and make it fatter here and shorter there.
Right.
For what reason? I think because they wanted it to play better in the altissimo.
Okay.
All right. So you remember that guy, altissimo? I knew Al Cohn.
Al Cohn and Zoot Sims, yeah.
Altissimo was a strange character. You know, you play up in the altissimo and your reeds last 2 seconds.
I wanted to ask you, you did a tour with Freddie Hubbard once, didn't you?
But you remember when I got, did I say that I became a Lighthouse All-Star because Bob Cooper became my teacher.
Okay.
And he worked at NBC before I did because he got the Dean Martin show.
Okay.
Which is a whole band playing every week on the Dean Martin show.
Right.
So I had to sub for him a couple days a week at the Lighthouse.
Right.
And Freddie came in because we played on Thursdays and Wednesdays and Thursdays. And the guys who were going to play on the weekend were always guys from New York or from out of town.
Right.
They were feature bands, and we were the all-stars who played during the week.
Right.
And in comes the Freddie Hubbard with the Jazz Messengers or something like that. And he was like, we were almost the same age.
Yeah.
And he came up and played, and we got to be friends. And right. And then after that, I'd run into him at a music store in L.A.
Right.
At Maury Stein's.
Right.
He hung out at Maurice Stein's at the Union. And so I'd get together with him, and we'd go in the back room where the piano was and where rehearsals were happening all the time. And he sat down at the piano and comped for me.
Oh, yeah.
And comped for me and played the daylights out of that piano. It's and great. I said, you know that tune Crisis or one of those other tunes that yeah. Hey, man, I want to play on that too. He says, well, what you do is you go like there, and then you do this, and you do that, do this and that. So he says, look, one, two, one, and we playing, and he's just roaring by it, and I'm playing. Then I went to Holland with him with a band, and we played.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, who was the pianist on that Holland? Do you remember who was? Was it?
You know, it was so long ago.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
It might have been Billy Childs.
It might have been Cedar Walton.
Cedar Walton.
You know, because later I came back and I did a very, very important album with Freddie because he had decided that he was going to walk away from Creed Taylor and CTI Records making pop music kind of jazz and go back to straight ahead jazz. Right. And Junior Cook was the tenor player and Cedar Walton was the
pianist.
The piano player, and I forget who the drummer was, could have been anyway. And Ernie was sitting next to me. I was playing bass clarinet, tenor.
You could be talking about the Super Blue album. Are you on the Super Blue? Or that would have been Kenny Barron and I think so.
Could have been.
I think so.
This was definitely Cedar Walton.
Everybody Cedar Walton, okay.
Yeah. And it was a coming out album.
Right.
The first album he made after
CTI.
And he was telling me, we were riding around I was just hanging with him in Holland, and we had to take a limo to the gig. Right. It was a radio hall where all the concerts took place in Holland.
Right.
You know, and so we went to the radio station in a taxi or whatever, and I asked him whatever happened to all that, you know, and he said, well, when I quit CTI, he said, Creed Taylor was so angry at me. You know, he took on a trumpet player, you know, in New York, you know, the guy that Cedar. I'll think of it. You know, you get old timers and
right.
And I have to, what's my name? You know, so it ain't at any rate. He got angry at and he gave this guy, the next guy,
a contract,
a contract, and paid him like an exorbitant amount of money that Freddie never saw.
Mm.
Yeah. So you can imagine that. He got that mad. He gave this guy $1 million.
I mean, there's a lot of I have to say, I unlike a lot of people, I think that Freddie's albums with CTI are among the best albums. I think those are incredible.
Oh, yeah.
Period. Whether Red Clay or First Light or any of those, you know.
Oh, sure.
Music is really top notch. But then there's a.
As well, you if said, ever I heard him in a club with a band just roaring, playing straight into jazz, it's the most thrilling thing, man. Because he could fly.
Oh, yeah.
And he could play beautiful.
Yeah.
I still think he's one of the greatest jazz trumpeters ever. Yeah. And man, I worked with Chet Baker, he was a natural and he could play so lyrical. And he could, I saw him play out.
Yeah.
Because we worked a gig together.
Yeah.
And he still owes me $300. Oh, never mind. He played a whole chorus in one breath. Because his ideas coming out and he just couldn't get off of it, man. And he'd play this whole chorus in one breath, and it was a lyrical masterpiece, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And anyway, so what's next? I mean, I did all that stuff. And it was a long time. Then I came back off the road and all this stuff. And how I got the Tonight Show was that Louie was the drummer on the Tonight Show band that came out when the show came out from New York to play in California for a week or two during the summer. It was a hiatus from New York, and they
right.
said, we're in Hollywood, you know. So yeah. Louie was the drummer on that band.
Uh-huh.
So when they came out, Doc Severinsen and Louie, they did some concerts around the area with Louie's band and Doc Severinsen playing his, you know, feature stuff, Mulligania right. or something like that, and dressed like a bullfighter, you know. So then Johnny Carson would be on stage.
Right.
It's like a theater and around things.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever. But Johnny would go and do it card tricks and do stuff. And they had a singer. At any rate, it was a variety show doing with it. So that's how I got involved with playing the Tonight Show band when they came out from New York. So I was in that band. It's,
right.
it's like a great 2-week gig, you know. Yeah. And you're up there, and it's like, I'm playing with the Tonight Show band. There's Johnny Carson. I used to watch it on TV, but man, being there in person, it was like, wow, can you imagine that? You know, this is how it all works.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at that, and I'm not looking at Doc, and he's counting, because the band has to be ready to go like a firehouse thing, you know, boom, because we're behind commercials and we have to be playing. And I was looking there and I wasn't paying attention, and bam, the band starts playing, and I put my horn up and put the mouthpiece right in my nose, wrecked the reed, and now I'm bleeding up here. I'm just trying to play and change the reed, but boom, you know. And that was my first experience, and then it's all history. And 20 years later, you know, all the people that were on that show.
Right.
You know that he had Buddy Rich on the show
all the time. He loved Buddy Rich.
Well, you know that Buddy wasn't he wasn't big on reading. He wasn't a reader. He for his whole life he played by ear, and,
right.
and that's how I learned to play saxophone. I played by ear. I listened right. to guys' solos, and I tried to emulate them, and that's yeah. how I, you know, it took a while to hook up. Being a better, if you're going to work in a situation like the Tonight Show, you definitely need to know how to read.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it all kind of took a while, but it all came together. And I ended up doing other things in Hollywood and meeting people and playing variety shows and things like that. It was just something that was lucrative and it's a good living, and you have to be versatile. I think, you know, the standard is that if you play a saxophone and you're going to work and do record dates with people that come to town, it could be Frank Sinatra or Keeley sure. Smith. Or I love working with Keeley Smith, because she always used to come out to the jazz clubs where we were playing with Louie Belson, and jump on the stand and sing and hang out. And she became a good friend. And then I started doing her show when she came to town. She lived in Palm Springs or something like
right.
that. Wonderful singer. God,
she was a wonderful singer.
And she had a piano player, was just a wonderful writer. And and so we did variety stuff like that. And then I did a show with it's where I first started it before I worked at CBS.
Okay.
When I got off the road, everything is in retrospect. Have you noticed? I got off the road with the size of the Zentner band, and this is just before Louie Belson and all that stuff.
Yeah.
you know, I did a show at CBS, Glenn Campbell.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The Good Time Hour? Was it the Good Time Hour?
I got to work with some guys, you know, sit next to guys like Roy Clark and Buck Owens. He really played the violin, man. He was a great jazz violin player.
Interesting. You know?
And Jerry Reed and these guys, they could play jazz. And Glenn Campbell was a hell of a jazz guitar player. I mean, he'd made his living doing the country western thing and all the other stuff, but he could solo, he could play that. He could really play.
Yeah.
And so it was very interesting playing with these people, you know, and they were all just great characters, you know, to hang out with. Then that just at about that time, that's when the thing, the week here, week there with the Tonight Show band started. So it was a transition period. And then it was quite a while before they decided to come to California and make it a go for the rest of the show
right.
in California. And
when you guys moved to the California, that's when Carson reached his, you know, his peak. And that's when the band yeah. never sounded better. And I'm thinking, in the midst of all that, you're also doing, so you mentioned that you're on Taking It Pelham 1-2-3, David Shire's score.
Yeah. That was just one of those things that you're in. You know, the Tonight Show goes from 5 PM to 6 PM. And there's a rehearsal at 3 PM or something about that. But these dates go on in 9 AM.
Right.
We had some of us. We had off days at the Tonight Show because you remember Doc had a band that was traveling on the weekends, and so he wanted those guys to have a shot at the show.
Sure,
because it supplemented their income, and it gave me a chance to work the Campbell show. Or then it was Sonny and Cher. I worked at Sonny and Cher for 7 years.
Wow,
a wonderful man named Jimmy Dale who came in, is one of those kind of guys that he came in on the night before and sat with a copyist person, and he sat down and wrote a whole show in about 3 hours. You know, there are people like that. Billy May
was like that.
He could compose on a napkin, a symphony on a napkin in 15 minutes. You know, he was just,
when you say that Pat Williams was like that too, was Pat Williams?
I'm sure most of the time he had it all together. When you have a date with Pat Williams, you go in there and once in a while you'd have a solo and it'd be cool, you know, everything like that. And, he did the theme for, a couple of television shows. You know, Odd Couple. Did he do the theme for the Odd Couple?
Odd Couple was Neil Hefti, but I don't know.
Oh, that's right. But that's right. That was
Neil Hefti. But Patrick Williams was NTM, Mary Tyler Moore, and wrote it. I mean, not wrote it, but
yeah, Mary Tyler Moore,
Lou Grant, and all that, and late 70s, but I'm just wondering if there's anything you remember that was unique about David Shire as a composer or as a writer or that score. Or
you never get too close to these people. You're sitting about 50 feet away and you're following the conductor and you go to work and you play horn, get check, go home. You know, that's kind of the way things go. And I noticed that he, you know, some people they write a little bit more ornamental and makes it a little more complicated.
Okay.
So you really have to be on the ball.
Yeah.
You know, because the whole thing about this, everything breezes along and then there's a moment of sheer terror for you because you're all alone.
You mean a solo or so?
And the music looks like a bomb went off in a BB factory. There's goddamn many notes.
Are you saying that David Shire was like that in places or no?
He wrote, hey, you know, that's the way it is. Film writers, they learn from who they were. They learn from the classics.
Right.
That's where all the great music came from, you know, all these great writers. And for my dad, Bernard Herrmann was a great friend. Bernard Herrmann loved bassoons, so there's always a lot of bassoons.
Bassoon solos.
Yeah, you know,
hey, Pete,
story about that was very interesting.
Okay.
My father was playing with Bernard Herrmann because Bernard did some, he was one of the writers at 20th Century Fox under Alfred Newman had a, when he started, Alfred Newman recruited musicians from all over the place. He came to MGM. My father was working in MGM and he says, Don, I'm taking over the music department at Fox and I'm starting an orchestra. I will write solos for you in the motion pictures and I want you to join my crew.
Right.
And Dad said, yeah. What time? What? I'll be there, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So, and then 50 years later, he wrote a book. So that 50 years of, you know, being an emotional, he did some, like I said, 700 plus movies at in that time. And the composers were Dave Raxon. And Dave was in our house all the time. He became a champion for me.
Well, David Raskin wrote Laura, you know, right? The theme.
Man. It was the most recorded.
Raskin was your champion. He liked
in
your
history in the Library of Congress. It was one of the most recorded music pieces of music in the history of this whole thing. It held the record for many, many, many years. It's, you know, people licensing it to record it and record it and record it and record it. That it's a very popular tune.
That is.
I put it on one of my albums. I had Bill Holman do the chart.
Bill Harmon, great writer.
Bill Holman, yeah. Fantastic. Fan, you know.
So, I don't think anybody wrote contrapuntally like Bill Holman, right? That was his. That was the way he wrote the lines. And that was his.
Yeah, that's true. And I tell people, well, how was it like to play in Bill Holman's band? Well, because of the way he wrote like that, you almost are the only one playing that particular line. And if you're playing something with the guy next to you, you're probably lost because that's not how it's supposed to be. Yeah, so paying attention and playing his charts year in and year out, you go to the rehearsal because he liked to rehearse every week.
Uh-huh.
You know. And you can't just take it for granted, but you have to count. Because wherever you come in is, it's not where the other guy's count is different than yours. So you can't. Where are we? I don't know. I'm here. You're there. Tough.
How about Johnny Mandel as a writer for his
absolutely the most beautiful, lush. Right. He had this knack of the color in the chord.
Oh, yeah.
He orchestrated. It was so beautiful, and you almost would be stop and listen rather than play because it was that good, you know. And he was my uncle.
Oh,
boyhood buddy because they went to school together, and my uncle was his doctor.
Oh, okay.
My uncle played bass. And he was the musician, the jazz doctor, they called him.
That's right.
And Johnny was one of his patients, and a lot of other guys that I work with would go to my uncle, the jazz doctor.
The jazz doctor.
Yeah. And he had sessions at home all the time. So.
Well, if for audiences unfamiliar with his writing, I would recommend the Sandpiper score of Jack Sheldon. And that's a score. Talk about beauty.
That's definitely a classic, isn't it?
Yeah, that or Agatha or
I love that tune.
Yeah.
You know. I play it all the time, the theme from Agatha.
Right.
You know. And so he was doing motion pictures a lot, but I was doing other things, and then it took a while. He started his own band.
He did. He
just
did.
Decided out of nowhere. He'd never had a band before in LA, so he started a band, and we started playing in places.
So Pete, have you played a part of the score of I Want to Live, some of the themes from
Yes, we did that.
Susan Hayward. And...
I was playing the other horn. I was playing tenor, but the solo was down on the baritone.
Yeah.
Because it was Jerry Mulligan.
It was Jerry Mulligan, yeah.
Yeah. I got to meet him when I was a kid.
Jerry Mulligan?
Yeah. It was really something.
Jerry Mulligan is underrated as a writer. He's a good writer.
Oh.
Good arranger.
Isn't that... Well,
yeah, he did.
Between him and Bob Brookmeyer, who
were
brothers,
yeah.
They wrote some of the most incredibly beautiful music. And I have a few of the charts, the concert jazz band stuff. Okay. And when I was growing up, I had a records of the concert jazz band playing in New York, you know, and playing at, downtown, the club they recorded at. Excuse me. Clark Terry was in the band, and I got to play with him. Mm-hmm. I sat next to him and played.
Wow.
And he was the funniest guy. He could hardly, he liked to have fun. And he could play. Man, could he play. Jeez. Wonderful guy. Everything. And I got to another guy who was one of the funniest guys in the world to play with, Frank Rosalino. Mm-hmm. He was incredibly funny. You know, like Robin Williams. He would...
Right.
Take off, man, and fly around,
man. And eventually
Johnny Carson would just sit there and just in amazement.
Yeah.
And being Johnny Carson, a big-hearted guy like and a smart man, would just stay out of the way and let him go crazy, and the audience would be on the floor, and he would just sit there and it was amazing.
How about Pete Barbuti? Any?
I worked with him. We got to play. He started calling me for gigs.
Oh, good.
He's, and because he's a jazzer.
He
always was a jazzer, you know. Oh. Other than the fact that he could play the piano with his nose.
Yeah.
He didn't have any other gags that he did. He had this old trumpet that was run over, and bell was over here and keys were over here, and it would squeak. It wouldn't play, but he had a little bit about a fourth trumpet player sitting in a band and everything. And all the things that he did, he'd sell a joke and he'd turn around and I'm standing there with my ornament. He says, "Isn't that right, Pete?" And I said, "Yeah." And I get a laugh, see? Okay. Isn't that right?
a friend of mine who's a big Tom Waits buff wanted me to ask you about touring with Tom Waits.
Nobody like Tom.
Hmm.
My first experience, my piano player, one of the greatest, and man, Mike Melvoin. Mm-hmm. Could play that piano. One of my favorite records. My favorite records is Live at Dino's with my band, and my band was Nick Cirilli, who played on Bob Florence's stuff.
That's right. Cirilli,
and Jim Huart.
Jim Huart.
Who we've been friends for years, and I still talk to him on the phone. And Mike Melvoin.
I need to interject, but Jim Huart is the bassist on Barney Miller, right? He's the Barney Miller.
Of course.
That was Chuck Berghoffer. Berghoffer, yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm close, though.
Jim worked with he worked with everybody at least twice.
Right.
including Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett. And when I first started playing with Jim, he had come off the road playing with Ella Fitzgerald.
Right.
Yeah. And Jim could write. He wrote, man, when we started working with Natalie Cole, remember when all that happened? Natalie, the Unforgettable album. There's one solo that I played. You know, it's like you could hear yourself playing in every bathroom, airport bathroom in the world.
Patrick Williams was one of the writers on that, Natalie Cole, wasn't he?
Who's that?
Wasn't Pat Williams one of the arrangers on that?
There was on that album. Johnny Mandel did a lot of them. Because that Unforgettable was originally a Nelson Riddle composition for Nat King Cole, because Nat he had all the Nelson's charts on his albums and stuff, and that was the first time that anybody I think ever put an artist from the past with
a modern
Natalie Cole, with his daughter playing together and putting it all together. It was quite a mechanical breakthrough, you know. Anyway,
when that album came out, that made that kind of music popular, right? To a larger, you know, in other words, that's the thing to me about jazz or swinging music or non-rock popular music, is that it comes and goes. Sometimes it's big, sometimes, you know, it ebbs and flows, and it kind of that. I feel like that album came out and people started to rediscover, hopefully, Nat King Cole's piano playing.
It became a gig, steady gig for several years.
Yeah.
Because when we did a lot of concerts after the album came out, we did our part, whatever we did on the record, and I had to play my solo.
Oh.
This is a very interesting something to talk about. When I grew up and I was playing with a guy who wrote String of Pearls and all of Glenn Miller's, a lot of Glenn Miller hits, and his name was Jerry Gray. And my father knew Jerry Gray because he played on the Glenn Miller story thing in the studio when they did the film.
You mean the Jimmy Stewart?
Jerry Gray was there orchestrating, you know, the Glenn Miller music for the orchestra and everything. And anyway, Tex Beneke walked in one night, who I had was one of the first records, jazz records in the house, was either Jerry Mulligan or Tex Beneke in the Miller Band.
Right.
Tex had a kind of a Coleman Hawkins sound, big barrel-y sound. And
he did, yeah. He did.
And everything. And he took me to, he said, I was just 16 years old or something. We were playing dance music at downtown in Vegas. And he was out on the strip with the Tex Beneke Band and the Modern Airs. And he says, I want to, when you're through working tonight, he says, I'll pick you up and I'll put you down in front and you can see the show at the Sahara or something like that.
Right.
So he says, don't order any drinks or do anything funny. Like, I was 16 or 17 years old.
Sure.
So I sat there. The one thing I noticed that every tune that Tex had a solo on was the solo on the record.
Oh.
So it was customary in those days, if you had a hot record going, man, you played the solo that was on the record because the people want to hear that.
Because people recognize that as the
people recognize it.
Right.
Well, I had that solo with Natalie.
Yeah.
And we were playing at, we played concerts everywhere in LA. And we were playing at the Greek Theater.
Nice theater.
Yeah. And I did concerts there with other people, of course, but this was our band, and I had, you know, like, I play alto flute on this tune, and I play clarinet on this tune, and you play tenor on most of it. And then I stand up and do my solo. I changed my solo just a little bit on Unforgettable.
Yeah.
She got pissed off. Shitty. What you do that for? You know. Okay, I'm sorry, you know.
Huh.
My solo that's on the record is written on the sheet music, on the part. It's written in for the tenor player, wherever band they're playing with somewhere, because they traveled all over the world. The guy had to read my solo.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that course, solo, I mean, that...
People have me music with my solo written out, and I can't play it. Too many notes. What was I thinking?
I mean, you were approaching it like most normal situations, right? Ordinary,
yeah.
But ordinary in the contemporary scene where you would do
Harry Sweets Edison used to play solos with two or three notes in them.
That's right.
And he played the right note in the right place, and people go crazy.
That's right.
You see, when you get older, you don't have to play a whole lot of notes. You just play the ones you played on the record. See?
That's right.
you get, you know, it's better. Okay, yeah, I'll go for that. You know. So what's next?
I think that we've talked about so many things. Is there any we didn't mention Chet Baker yet. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to bring everything down necessarily.
He was a character. He was character. The first gig that I worked with Chet before we went on the road, because I learned after that the thing that you could say to all the young musicians, you know, who were going to go play in jazz groups and play with people like Chet Baker, is if you're working for the junkie, you're working with the junkie.
Oh, yeah.
If you're going out of town, get your money first.
Get the money up front.
Yeah.
Get the money before you go.
He stranded us. He stranded me and some pretty popular guys in town. He stranded all of us in Colorado.
Wow.
Took the money and split.
Wow.
And it was great. I had to call home. Hey, how's the career going? Well, Mom, I need a couple of bucks to get home.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, but during that time, it was a club in Colorado. And I have a tape somewhere I did. The drummer was a guy who was a wonderful drummer, who kind of played like Philly Joe Jones. And
yeah.
He was a Air Force. He was in the Strategic Air Command.
Oh.
And his name was Harry Kivas.
Yeah.
And he was one of the great drummers.
Sure.
And he could just swing. And he had a recorder going all the time. Just out of habit, he did that. So he recorded everything we did with Chet Baker.
Wow.
I tell you, it was an experience. I think I was an influence on Chet. I think I was. Because lyrically, he was always one of the most lyrical players.
He was, yeah.
You know, and so I think I booted him a little bit from where I was coming from, and he sure made me think. About, you know, first of all, phrasing, you know,
phrasing, yeah.
The way he hung his phrases together and everything. And you see, in this day and age, everything is changed. You know, we're in the world of the Michael Brecker thesaurus of
notes,
melodic patterns, and everything. And everything, solos are like. A Chinese erector set, you know. You know, it is the lyrical thing is kind of put away for this, all these complicated.
That's right.
Interval solos at
intervallic solos,
300 miles an hour.
And, yeah.
You know, and believe me, I really thought he was the most incredible saxophone player I'd ever heard in my life. Yeah. And he was complimentary to me because out of nowhere, he told some guy, if you're in L.A. and you're going to do a record, and if you want somebody to do your solo, call Pete Christie.
Yes.
And he never, we never ever really talked.
Okay.
But he did recommend me for a gig. So I know he was listening to me, and I certainly was listening to him. And
Sure.
It's breathtaking what he could do with the saxophone. The altissimo world, my best friend for a long time is Paul. His name is Paul Perez, and he wrote a book. This is, see that? Playing in the attic. Huh. Paul was one of the featured saxophone players with the Tower of Power.
Yeah.
And an expert at this. The book. You read the book, learn how to play. And there's so many things that a saxophone player has to do to be absolutely fluent and make all these high notes, this third register thing, work. And it has a lot to do with what you do with your throat and how you put the air and your jaw. And this book is, you have to do the calisthenics,
right,
with the air. And man, the reed has to be just right, you know, to be able to do that, you know. So, oh, thank you. Oh, okay. Linking to your website? Oh, doing what?
Make the podcast to your website.
Oh, it's almost over.
We're at right.
Look, I got a note here. It says, bring home Chinese food. Now,
there's a lot of Chinese.
So that's a very difficult situation. And then I see people doing it. I was doing playing instruments at at the NAMM show.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go to the NAMM show, there's so much going on, man. There's a guy playing this lick over and over and over again, and he won't for 3 hours.
Huh.
You know, and there's another guy. Then there's guitars, man. There's a billion guitars just going absolutely nuts, and drums, and it's just going on. I was with a company for a long time, Cannonball Saxophones, and very nice people, wonderful people. And they made a horn that played, and it didn't cost $11,000, or, you know, at least less than half of that that could play. So it was an alternative. You know, kids coming up, the kid's father is a farmer. My father's father was a farmer.
Huh.
And if he told his father that a bassoon cost 30 grand, the farmer would, after he woke up from fainting, you know, he said, are you nuts? You know, get on the tractor, get out there and, you know, earn your keep.
Right.
So dad didn't like that. That kind of life. Sure. You have to save up for that first bassoon. In those days, they were $18,000 in the 40s. And it takes 3 years to build one.
Wow.
And they come from Wiesbaden, Germany, Heckel, the Heckel company.
Yeah.
And my father's first bassoon, my uncle Maury, who was an angel, my mother's brother. My mother had Ralph, my Uncle Ralph, the jazz bass player, was my mother's brother. And Maury was the other brother. And Maury was in the occupation army in 45 or whatever. Occupation of Germany, 45, 46, whatever, you know. He went with my father's $16,000 in his pocket, went to the Heckel factory. And Heckel... Heckel was there and knocked on the door, and he was, My sister's husband would like you to build a bassoon, and here's the money. And he says, well, it was for an American. He was still a Nazi. Mm-hmm. No. Maury, he went to the PX at the army camp, and he got nylons and chocolates and things like that that they couldn't get. And he gave them to Mrs. Heckel. Mrs. Heckel went out there and says, you're going to make this guy a bassoon. So he made him a bassoon. That's how my father got his first Heckel. But it was like what a summer saxophone is to saxophone playing. The Heckel is the best bassoon, you know, and it's so complicated the way a bassoon is. Miles and miles of passageways that go here and there, bored into the wood, and they're all tapered. The boards are tapered. So it's so complicated. That's why it takes at least 3 years to build one. You know.
Yeah.
But it has such an, if you ever notice how the range is incredible from top to bottom, as soon as way down on the bottom to way
over
three octaves.
Wow.
And you wonder why I didn't play one? Well, I saw my dad playing that, practicing that damn thing every day so I could pull, you know. I mean, there's so many fingerings for the same note coming from this direction, and that was, it's a science. And you have to, believe me, I think the best thing you could have if you want to be a great bassoon player is to have a sense of humor and a lot of patience, because you'd be playing along with this double reed and a cloud goes over and the atmosphere changes and the reed stops. So you have to have a reed for all occasions. So you've got a box with the reeds for this reed, for this opinion. You know, it's like atmospheric conditions change. You have to change reeds. It's not enough just to spend 18 years to figure out how to play Mary Had a Little Lamb, but you got to have
one of the first girls I ever fell in love with was a bassoonist at long time ago at New England Conservatory of Music. So you're bringing back memories of bassoon, watching her practice bassoon and making.
Yeah.
That was.
It's called Ben, somebody who really dedicated, you know. But I told those guys every time I was doing clinics and classes with people and helping them play, mostly getting over the jitters of playing in front of other people. I mean, I listened to these kids in the practice room and I said, God, man, that guy, he's a whiz. You know, and you get him out in front of a bunch of other people. I don't know why. You know, so, hey, if it's a performing art, means you perform, and you're performing in front of a lot of people. So you got to get that out of your head.
Yeah.
If you're a pitcher, don't listen to the crowd. They're always telling you, they're always, you know, talking about your mama.
I want to thank you for your enormous generosity of spirit and your stories. And this is one of my.
I'd like to end up by saying what's going on now.
Yes, absolutely.
No, I mean, jazz, classical music and jazz are for a certain people with certain tastes. Intellect.
Yeah.
To understand it.
Right.
To understand it is to enjoy it. Understand. You know, the people who played in the symphony orchestra that my father, you know, played in Fox and everything, they threw things at them that orchestra people, you know, at least if they're playing Mahler this week and Beethoven next week, and but they played them many times. So they would get them out and brush up on it. But it isn't like a surprise. Playing in the motion picture and television business, everything comes at you. First of all, the music on a motion picture is the last thing to go on the motion picture. Mm-hmm. And the guy who's writing is so much under the gun. You know, I mean, he gets the music and they want it now. And so he's got a staff of people standing by and he's throwing pages at them, orchestrators, because he cannot, you cannot orchestrate and create music this fast without help.
Right.
And so orchestrators make, and so I said to the kids in the class, learn how to orchestrate, learn how to write music. You know, okay, you think, you know, oh, I got friends who play music, but the music business isn't a isn't constant, and there are slow times. And when there are slow times, and you have another occupation in music, like writing music or being an orchestrator, you get so much money per bar of music, you can make 10 times the money pinning out somebody's score than you can being in the orchestra playing. In other words, man, when you're playing in the band, you're not getting paid by the note. But when you're writing notes, you are getting paid by the note. And you make $500 with doubles playing on a motion picture in a couple of days, maybe $500, and make $5,000 helping the guy get the score done. He's got an X amount of money to do it, so he can afford to pass on a buck to get it done to make his money, you know. So that's just one other part of the music. And then the other part really is right now, like I live in Washington, and I came up here because I used to teach. One of my greatest friends ever was a wonderful man who really was a great musician and a great influence for me, was Bud Shank. And Bud Shank and Bob Cooper lived together on the bandstand at the Lighthouse when they were kids. And Bud, he brought flute into jazz, and Bob brought oboe into jazz at the same time. And the oboe didn't stick. I mean, Mitch Miller, but he, you know, that's not jazz.
Right.
And that's not improvising on oboe. But the flute, yeah, it stuck. It became very popular.
Sure.
You know. So, but all this is, my summer camp here in Washington was, I think I did it 18 years with Bud and learning how to influence and help other people play. A lot of my students are up here. They're working. I'm not working that much. I think the last gig I had was last March, last year. I spend more time with a weed eater in my hand than a tenor. You know, but my hobby has always been the racing cars. And I build engines, and I have two racing cars in the garage, and they sit in L.A. down in, actually sit in my kid's farm ranch down there, and we go racing down in California for a season every year, and the season doesn't even start till April. So I'm on hiatus and building things.
Yeah.
And looking for a reed.
Hmm.
The reed business.
That's Jesus right.
Christ, is it crazy? You know, cane just isn't what it used to be. Cane, my father, you know, bassoon cane, it's the same cane that saxophone reeds are made. I mean, it comes from the south of France, these cane fields.
Right.
And the families who built, in the 30s, 40s, whatever, that had huge cane fields, and they were selling cane, and there were 400 different manufacturers of reeds, and you had your choice. And now there's a few, like several French companies, you know, Lavaz, LeBlanc, not LeBlanc, but other French reeds. making reeds, saxophone reeds. And then there's Rico. And Rico doesn't even belong to Rico anymore. They're owned by a guitar company.
Hmm.
And the one thing constant with this whole thing is that the cane that makes these saxophone reeds is not the same reed cane. The cane that the reed is made out of is not the same as it was those years ago. And that's simply, I think, mainly because they're in such a hurry. They get this cane and they put it in they cut it down and they send it. They send it here and the reed company gets it and they put it in, they chop it and they put it in a machine and it spits out a reed and spits out a reed. But if the cane hasn't, it's like tobacco. They take tobacco and they cure it.
Hmm.
They put it in a shed and they let it cure for months and months and months. And then when it's cured, it makes good tobacco. Well, the same thing with a reed. Molecular structure of a fresh cut piece of cane is all over the place. It's wet. And if you let it cure and dry out in a dry place, and all of a sudden the structure gets closer together like that, and the moisture can't get through it, because fresh cut cane, you play on it and 2 minutes later it's waterlogged, and you throw that reed on the floor and get another one, and maybe two reeds to get through a tune. I mean, that's the difference between good cane and lousy cane.
Right.
There isn't much good cane available, but to the people who know where it is and get it first. So this is why all of the saxophone players have been under the gun. When you buy a box of reeds that costs $40 or $50, if you're lucky, you might get one reed out of all that that plays.
Yeah.
You know? And you know that I played a reed that was made by Rico, the Rico company. My father was a Rico person because he bought his cane in raw form, in cylindrical form, in bags, in big gunny sacks.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd bring it home. And my job when I was a youngster is I'd take a four-bladed punch thing and split the cane in four pieces, and he'd take that and put it on machines and profile it at machines that he had built. And he made bassoon reeds for other people and oboe cane and everything like that. So I was like a sideline of about a $25,000 a year business selling guys reeds. But he knew how to make a reed. And he knew what he knew. He could look at a piece like a saxophone reed and tell you if it was worth buying it or worth working on it, you know. So everybody's in such a hurry that, you know, like I've been doing this how many years, 50 years. I'm looking through boxes of reeds that I've had for years and years and years, and trying to find at least one good reed. I played that kind of reed. My sound with a plastic cover reed, it's a coating that the reed is dipped in. And the idea behind that synthetic coating was to stop the water from getting into the cane and make the reed last longer.
Right.
And it also had a little more edge to it, the sound, a little more edge to it. And that edge was part of my sound. And the other part of it was the mouthpiece that you put it on.
Mm-hmm.
Berg's was very successful. You ever get much into the different mouthpieces that,
right,
like Coltrane played this mouthpiece.
Right.
And you go back to Gene Ammons.
Gene Ammons and Sonny Stitt. Yeah.
Gene Ammons and Sonny Stitt.
Blues up and down.
Yeah.
Blues up and down.
got to work with him once. Yeah. Once. And he was a very, very nice man. And you'd see this guy been through a war. God, it's amazing.
Well, Pete, I want to say that.
Okay, so that was the thing about the Reeds and the kids learning the music and other things to supplement their income. And but there isn't much jazz per se as jazz that we know it, like the straight ahead jazz thing is.
But people can hear you and Linda Small, great trombonist, right? I mean, you two, when are you gonna?
You know, we have a few CDs that we make. I think we make CDs because it's more fun than sitting in a practice room,
right?
Doing that, you know, it makes you practice anyway, you know.
Well, thank you, and I really enjoyed this. This is real true.
I hope we've, you know, enlightened a few people.
I hope so. All this stuff is important. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me. And. And maybe another time.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. See you later.
Thank you.